it really felt like you guys turned the page on the 2015-16 teams over the last couple of weeks. And all of this stuff happens with the fallout of the fan base. And I wonder what these last few weeks have been for like for you.
Well, that's not my perspective at all. My perspective was we transitioned a young core of talent onto the field in Dan Jansen, Kevin Biggio, Bo Bichette, Vladdy Guerrero, Lourdes Gurriel, Derek Fisher, and, you know, supplanted playing those guys every single day. And somewhere around June 20th, not the last few weeks, we started competing at a much better level, kind of went from towards the bottom of the game to the top of the game in close and late games, and run differential improved from bottom of the pack to the top 10. And so I think we transitioned the core. We started competing at a much better level. That's part of the process of turning around a team and recognizing that nothing about distancing from 15 and 16 other than you can't cryogenically freeze players in time, and they sooner or later age, and we didn't have the internal alternatives to go to. So I'm extremely enthused about where we are right now and what the prognosis looks like for us moving forward.
But can you sympathize with the emotional attachment a lot of these fans, this fan base had for some of those players who they saw some great times with in 15 and 16?
Absolutely. I think the most thing I sympathize with is the frustration of not winning. And, you know, having been around the game for almost 30 years, you know, my experience is fans build strong emotional bonds and ties to players that are there when you win, particularly when they're guys that have the energy and passion of the last group of players. So I think what I'm trying to say is I feel confident that between the young group of guys we have out there now, as we grow and as we win, fans will have built new bonds and feel a new sense of passion. That's not uncommon in any situation where there's a turnover in players and no one at all wants to do anything other than win. If you don't feel bitter and frustration at doing anything other than winning ball games, then it's the wrong business. So I sympathize and share frustration at not winning and feel confident that we've got players that fans are going to both celebrate and build bonds with as we do win.
I think fans are, they always want the team to win, but they do understand that this group is now in a rebuild, and rebuilds take faith. And why should fans put their faith in you?
Well, I don't think it's about having faith in me. I think it's about seeing the product on the field, recognizing the talent on the field, seeing the way they're competing and going after it day to day, the kind of teammates they are, the leadership they've got, the track records they've had in the minor leagues, and the way they're competing in games. And if they want to believe in that and want to be a part of watching that grow and develop, then there's a core of fans that will do that. And there's other fans that are going to wait and be skeptical and wait for us to win. And that's a prerogative as well. That's all. That's part of the sports business as well. So I guess what I would say is we need to produce. We need to win. And short of that, you're going to have, you know, some hardcore baseball fans or some true blue Blue Jay fans that stay engaged along the way, and others will come back. That's not unique to Toronto. That's a similar in all professional sports. And having been through some turnover of teams in the past, I've seen the regeneration of a fan base, and what 15 and 16 did was demonstrate the incredible potential and passion for this city and this country around baseball.
Yeah, the Houston Astros lost 90 plus games for four straight years, and people came back because, you know, they were winning World Series. So
exactly.
I think we get, or at least I do, get bogged down on timelines and wondering, like, when is the competitive window for this group? Because we've seen some pretty good early returns on the offensive players. How much are you using the last month and a half of the season as something that will guide you in your plan this offseason?
Yeah, that's probably the single most difficult question when you talk about time frames, the most frustrating one for me too, because I think in the end, there's, you don't want to ever set a limit to how fast it can happen. At the same time, you know, it's so unpredictable because players are human beings and development paths are never a straight line. There's always some ups and downs, as we've seen with guys like Lourdes Gurriel and Teoscar Hernandez. And so some guys are going to transition seamlessly and other guys are going to have ups and downs along the way. I think for us, the issue is going to be we've transitioned a core of young players now. Now we have to teach them not just how to compete, but how to win, finish their development at the major league level, which it's great that we've got Charlie Montoyo and such a development-focused staff that create a positive growth environment for our players. And then we've got to, you know, line up pitching. So whether it's the waves of guys coming that have already seen time here, guys like Thornton, Wagaspec, Pannone, Barucki, Reed Foley, the guys that are coming right behind him, Nate Pearson, Kay, who we just traded for, Merriweather, Pat Murphy, Diaz, Zoic Perez, or even the guys behind them, Manoa, Pardino, Castillo, Woods, Richardson, Klopfenstein. You know, I could keep going, but we've got to transition those guys up here and line those guys up, you know, with our position players.
Yeah, those guys do feel a little bit further behind what we're seeing from the offensive side of the ball, though, right? And if we are looking at the start of 2020, does the majority of the composition of the pitching staff to you comprise of guys like that, or could we see guys who are from outside of the organization?
I think it's likely we'll have some guys outside of the organization. I think in the end, you know, being realistic about that, if we can develop, even from that broad group of names I gave you, if we can develop three quality starters from that mix, the guys that stay healthy, and other guys will end up being bullpen guys, and some guys will end up not quite being what we think they're going to be. But we're going to have to at some point, and I think starting this offseason, think about either acquiring or signing, you know, starting pitchers that complement the existing group we've got internally.
And so could that involve trading younger pieces?
Well, there's multiple ways to acquire talent. Free agency or trades represent the ways to do it. So it could be either one of those two.
What I mean is, with what you've seen from this group already, or what you could see, a part of Ben's question earlier when it comes to this last month and a half, could it embolden you to, say, move off of younger prospects in help of, yeah, pieces that could help you now?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're definitely, when the window is right, we are definitely going to be open to trading young prospects in order to acquire players that help now. I mean, we just traded Cal Stevenson as part of a trade, who was an A-ball outfielder, in order to get Derek Fisher, who's a major league outfielder. So, again, I think it'll be a challenge to line up on trades as the group is kind of still moving towards competing to winning. When the wins start to be most valuable, and all wins are not created equal, so the wins between 82 and 85 are not as meaningful as the wins between 87 and 90. But when the wins are most meaningful, when the wins are most valuable, whether it's dollars or players, I think we're gonna not spare any cost to get what we need to get us over the hump.
Talking to Toronto Blue Jays president and CEO Mark Shapiro. Yeah, I think most people understand that the pitching side of things, it's a little bit more of a work in progress, and we haven't seen any of those upper-level prospects yet at the major league level. So the jury's still out, I think, for fans on them. But, yeah, position player-wise, things look pretty good. Do you feel like 1 through 9, you're almost set position player-wise going forward?
That's a great question. You know, I think the reality is just kind of it takes 500, 600 at-bats in the big leagues, sometimes even a little bit longer, to be sure of what you got. But again, I'm emboldened by the track records of these guys. I feel bullish because of the way they go about their business and having, you know, I sometimes wish we could give fans the first row seat we've got into the way these guys work, the way these guys practice, the way they take care of each other in the clubhouse, the energy and passion that they've got for the game. Those things to me are all really good markers for players and teams that can do special things. So, you know, we've got a really good lineup of catchers. I love Danny Jansen because even as he struggled offensively, he's been committed to getting the most out of our pitching staff and been solid defensively. But behind him, Reese McGuire, Riley Adams, Moreno and Kirk, we've got, you know, I think we'll figure out catching from that group of guys. We've obviously got Rowdy, who's gone down to AAA and really done some positive things. And, you know, I think we'll solve the infield pitcher from the group of guys, regardless of where guys play. We'll solve it from that group. And I think that we've got some guys that are going to make up the outfield. We could end up needing one outfielder. We could end up saying there's an opportunity for a DH from external to add a veteran bat at some point, but hopefully the position player is more fine-tuning than feeling that we need to fill core needs. I think we've got a group of guys who could fill all of our core position player team.
Mark, I don't think you'll find a Blue Jays fan in the city who's not excited about the young core of Bobichet and Vlad and Cavan and Lourdes Gurriel Jr. But you must have seen it. The vitriol that was directed towards your front office, specifically around the trade deadline. Was there something missed in the messaging from your front office to fans, and something you would like to clarify, or is this just part of a club that's going through a transitional phase?
Again, I think frustration, if you look back at the history of trades, they can't be evaluated in the immediacy after the trades. It's just extremely difficult. Whether it was Tampa Bay trading David Price for Willy Adames and being, you know, panned for getting Willy Adames back, who was not in the top 100 and no one had heard of him. And, you know, it takes time. Adames didn't get to the big leagues right away. He didn't have an all smooth path, but it ultimately ends up now looking like maybe a superstar player. Or even, you know, to bring back a familiar name, Josh Donaldson, goes from the Cubs to Oakland in a trade for Rich Harden, and you know, Chris Gallagher's the main guy going to Oakland. JD runs out of options after being optioned and struggles in the minor leagues, struggles in the big leagues, and takes a long time to become the player he is. So, and I went through it in Cleveland trading Cliff Lee, a Cy Young Award winner, for a trade that was looked at as, you know, panned as largely terrible. And Carlos Carrasco is still, as he recovers from cancer now, but he still recovers, but still helping the Indians win games, and obviously won very, very valuable World Series and playoff games. So, again, immediacy is not the right time to evaluate trades. I can sympathize with frustration and emotion at losing players who have meant a lot to the fan base, but I'm confident in the process that our scouts and our analytics staff and our front office went through. I'm confident that we maximized the value and the timing with those players, and I believe over time that will be told.
Yeah, the Carrasco trade was good. Getting Corey Kluber, I think, for Jake Westbrook was a similarly pretty good trade. Yeah, it worked out, I would say. It's gone
for Carlos Santana.
Yeah. Those are trades, though, that are kind of different than the ones we saw in 2015, right? That were very high risk and obviously high reward, as a whole generation of Blue Jays fans were kind of birthed over a couple of years there with the playoff runs that this team had. And I think there's a lot of fans in the city who wonder if, when the time is right, will you be open to taking those type of risks in trade?
Let's hope I get the chance to show that with Ross and prove that.
Well, that opens up another question. I don't know if you've been on record with your contract status, but how comfortable do you feel that your front office will be given that opportunity?
Not something I give any thought to. I don't talk about my contract status publicly. I don't view the front office to be the news. I view it to be the players in the field. And again, I'd get back to the message that we keep coming back to. We just need to win. Everything else takes care of itself. So the only thing I'm focused on is what I can control day in and day out, which is, you know, moving towards that with every bit of urgency we possibly can, controlling every single thing we can possibly control in order to have that happen sooner, as soon as possible. Everything else takes care of itself.
Well, part of that is high performance, right? And I think some people were breathing a sigh of relief just seeing Bobichet in the lineup tonight. There was a little bit of fear he would not play in the home debut because of the rest schedule that seems to be employed with some of these young players. And there have been criticisms about the high performance department. And I wonder, from your perspective, is that more about the results of it so far, or is that just the difficulty of implementing a schedule where you're asking players not to play baseball?
Well, Charlie makes out the lineup. You know, I think our job is to make sure he's got the resources around him that keeps players on the field over the long term. I think the reason why there's frustration with that is either media or fans that are dealing with something that's relatively new to the game, not just in Toronto, but every single team that does deploy the information to best manage player loads. We have so much more information now that helps us understand fatigue mainly. And, you know, players get hurt when players are fatigued, whether it's larger frame bodies or whether it's the grueling nature of road trips and coming off of flights and travel. You know, we have an understanding now that we didn't used to have of what it takes, rather than anecdotally, but more precisely, what it takes to keep a player feeling energized, healthy, and ultimately on the field for the long term. So there's short, we fight the short-term desire just to see a player, or the short-term desire to have maybe a better lineup, you know, in a single day, with the thought that over the long term we want the player to be productive over an entire career and have him on the field more than possible. And that can be the absolute difference maker, you know, in a team being a contender or a champion.
So have we basically closed the book on guys playing 162?
I would say it will be very, it would be a very rare case, if ever, of that happening again. But I think they're probably, again, I don't believe it. There are strict black and whites. You know, everything is somewhat gray, but I think the likelihood of that is the stakes have gotten higher and salaries are higher and the understanding of the value of players is so much higher, and as well as the performance of them, I think it's highly unlikely.
So you mentioned it, Charlie makes the lineup. Is it he who solicits the information when it comes to that scheduled rest? How does it work in terms of getting that information about when is the right time to sit these guys?
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be difficult to understand, but everything's collaborative. You know, we've got a, whether it's Nicky Huffman, Scott Peters, or, you know, our strength and conditioning staff, you know, whether it's our, you know, the position coach, you know, there's a Dave Hudgens, our bench coach, will coordinate all the information, sit down with Charlie and plan lineups out for a week. And then they'll take information as it comes up day to day, and nicks and bruises and other things that might come up or something exceptional that may occur. And they'll adjust off of those lineups to put us, you know, combine to put us in the best position to compete and be successful, along with the best position to keep players on the field.
Talking to Mark Shapiro, it's Primetime Sports, Ben Ennis, J.D. Bunkus. So it's funny, we talk about pitching so much with this team and what it'll look like going forward, but we should really be addressing it as run prevention, right? And there's two aspects to that, and defense is a part of it. And we've seen some growing pains from some of the young players, especially the ones on the infield. How much of a priority will defense be going forward for this team?
Well, I think you already answered your own question. It's about preventing runs. You know, it's really about scoring and preventing, and there are multiple ways to prevent, and there are multiple ways to score. But when it comes to preventing runs, you can do that through strikeouts and not put balls in play, or you can do that with putting balls in play and playing great defense and positioning as well. And this day and age has become a potential opportunity for advantage. So I think you pointed out one of the facts of playing young players that can be painful. Adrian Beltre, when he transitioned, one of the greatest defensive third basemen of all time, led the National League in errors as he transitioned at 21 years old to third base. So I find that defense is one of the most challenging areas as players transition from AAA to the big leagues. The speed of the game, the strength of the players, the nature of the ballparks, the game is so much faster at the major league level. So I would view that as it's part of the transition.
So we see some changes are coming to the Rogers Center with some protective netting coming, and I don't think it's been clear as to exactly where it's going to extend at this point. But a big part of your mandate, especially early on, was talking about changes to the Rogers Center and making the fan experience better. Is there any plan upcoming for next season in terms of improving the experience for fans?
Yeah, I mean, that's something we're working on right now, and I would hope as we move into the off-season messaging in about, you know, 7, 8, 10 weeks, we've got some strong announcements about fan-facing projects that will improve fan experience next year. This year, we spent the bulk of the money putting a new roof and finishing up waterproofing, refreshing the 100-level concourse, which if you've been to a game, you'd know is dramatically different, and building a new premium club behind home plate. Next year, we'll have other changes that will impact our fans positively.
Mark, congratulations on the young players and how well they've played, especially recently, and thanks so much for doing this.
Thanks, Mark.
Yeah, my pleasure, guys.